Hello and welcome. This is an audio recording of an IFG live event.
Hello and welcome. I'm Georgina Wright. Cities around the world are seeing a resurgence in coronavirus cases. Some have had to reimpose lockdowns. Others have introduced curfews. There are boarded shops on the high streets. Meanwhile, citizens wait anxiously for normality to resume. But how are different countries responding? And what could the UK government learn from cities in the UK and abroad? To discuss all of this, I'm joined by a distinguished panel, Sir Peter Soulsby, Mayor of Leicester, Danielle Wood, Chief Executive Officer of the Grattan Institute in Melbourne, and Dr. Nicolas Bouquet, Director of Research and Transformation of Public Policy at the Institut Montaigne in Paris. Welcome to you all. Sir Peter, perhaps I could start with you. Leicester became the first city in Britain to be placed in a local lockdown on the 29th of June. Measures were relaxed a bit last week, I saw, with casinos, indoor skating rinks, bowling alleys and conference halls reopening. In your view, how did the public respond to these new restrictions? And did you see a difference in their attitudes to the first time round?
Yes, as you say, we have the dubious honour of being the first UK city to have individual action at a local level. I'll be honest with you, it came as quite a surprise to local people because at that stage, the testing that was taking place in the UK was at a very low level indeed, and the data that was coming through from that was were pretty sketchy at best. And certainly, although we've been saying, well, is there something wrong with our figures? Have we got higher figures? For a few weeks before that, the government was reassuring us that there was no need to worry. So it came as a bit of a surprise, both to us at the local administration, but also a complete surprise to the local people. I have to say, they couldn't understand why they'd been picked out.
And on that, do you think they've adjusted now? Have you sensed a difference?
I think there is inevitably in any community, very mixed reactions to it. But there are a lot of people in Leicester who still feel that the way in which we were singled out for that local lockdown wasn't entirely justified by the data, and that the fact that our figures, even ones we managed to get, show that we are way away from the top of the table, as it were, for those that have got the highest transmission of the virus. I think, there is a feeling that for us to have been picked out in the first place and to continue to be singled out for special restrictions is very hard to understand and justify. And there's a lot of frustration about it.
Great, thank you. And I'm hoping we can come back, actually, to sort of the identification and how the government goes about making those decisions. Danielle, maybe I could come to you next. So we know at the start of July, about 300,000 people were ordered back in localised lockdowns in Melbourne before a lockdown was imposed on the entire city. What has the mood been like in Melbourne, and have restrictions relaxed at all since July?
Look, I think it's fair to say the mood, particularly in the early stages of lockdown, was pretty grim. We'd gone through it once. We had a very brief taste of freedom, about 2 months. And then we were back into lockdowns again. So psychologically, that is tough. The other thing that made it harder, which I think, Peter was just alluding to, was the fact that the rest of the country wasn't in lockdown. So, you would have conversations with your friends and family in other parts of the country. They weren't sure whether it was appropriate to tell you about the lovely time they were having going out to restaurants or the cinema. There was actually even a spate of newspaper articles about the sort of correct etiquette when you were talking to Victorians and how not to make us feel too bad about ourselves. The other thing that did make it harder as well was that the lockdowns that we're currently still in were much stricter than the first round. So even though in the first wave we had what we call stage 3 lockdowns, so a lot of workplaces were closed, schools, gyms, restaurants, but we still did have actually a lot of retail was open, hairdressers were open, childcare was open. This time round we tried that slightly more relaxed approach. It didn't work. So we've gone to the very strict stage 4 restrictions. So much more aggressive shutdown of things like construction and manufacturing. We only able to leave the house once a day for 1 hour of exercise. You must wear a mask outside your house at all times, unless you're running. And there's also a curfew. So you can't be outside of the house between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. So culturally, that is a very big shock. But I would say, despite that, there has been widespread support for measures, and it varies a bit by measure, but all of those things have majority support across the population, according to polling, the whole way through the lockdown. And I think it has been helped by the success of the measures. We have seen case numbers come down very dramatically. Today, for example, we only had 12 new cases. That compares to more than 700 a day at the peak. So we are on track for some of the restrictions to be eased a little on Monday. And I can tell you that all Melburnians are very much looking forward to that.
That's really interesting. So, you know, you said these sort of measures short of lockdown have sort of, you know, have the confidence of people in Melbourne. But do you think they can contain the virus, particularly given the absence of sort of a functioning test and trace system?
Well, we certainly have brought it down to quite low levels. So as I said, 12 new cases today, and it's been in that sort of 10 to 20 range for most of the week. The stated goal of the government is to get to zero community transmission cases. Certainly many people believe that is feasible. But as you say, you know, getting a well-functioning track and trace system is really important as well, because what we saw when this second wave had the outbreak was really that we had a couple of super spreader events and it quickly got away from the government because that the contact tracing system just wasn't up to scratch.
I wonder if I can ask a question of Danielle. Danielle, are there sort of clear thresholds for the imposition of restrictions? And I think I heard you say that there were levels of restriction. Are they sort of clearly understood and nationally applied?
So they're not. They were broadly nationally applied the first time around. So the power is all with the state governments, but there's been a level of coordination via something they're calling the National Cabinet, which is all the state governments and our federal government. This time around, there was clearly a much bigger problem than Victoria than elsewhere. So we had a much more targeted approach at the city of Melbourne in particular. And what the government now has is essentially a plan for lifting restrictions. So it's a staged approach. It depends on the case numbers, more technically the 14-day rolling average of the case numbers, which is a pretty hard concept for the public to get their head around. And it basically sets out, you know, what restrictions will be lifted at what particular point in time.
Great. And I'm sure we'll come back to that later on as well. Nicola, in mid-August, the UK imposed a 14-day isolation requirement on all people arriving to the UK from France in response to the spike in the number of cases. Can you tell us a little bit more about the increase in infections across France? And are they sort of concentrated in some areas, or is it a case that cases have been increasing across the country?
Yes. I have to say the numbers are not good in France. We have 13,000 new cases a day, at least cases that are tested positive. We had more than 4,000 people hospitalized over last week. And we have now about almost 1,000 people in intensive care unit. So clearly, the numbers are not good. And there is a second wave. This second wave is different from the first one. The first one was exponential, and it hit very hard, a very limited number of parts of countries, mainly the east part of the country and the Paris region, where the situation was critical. Now, this second wave is more progressive, and it is hitting a little bit everywhere in the country. Clearly, the virus is circulating everywhere. And you now have more than half of the country in red on the map that was designed by the government to monitor the situation and at the point where the government has to find new colors and new nuances of red to create new categories. This was announced yesterday by the health minister, Olivier Véran, with new restrictions on Marseille and Guadeloupe and less milder restrictions on 11 cities. So it's really all over the territory, mainly in big cities, so metropolitan areas like Marseille, Bordeaux, Paris, and other cities where the virus is circulating. So there is a second wave. It's different, but it's coming. It could lead to a very important crisis of the health system. And until now, there has been more of a denial of the government that was more willing to say, let's go back to normal, let's live with the virus, and let's concentrate on the economy. and on the recovery plan. But yesterday's announcement was, I would say, kind of a change. And now everyone is aware that the situation is very dangerous and that we have to really act now if we don't want to come to more terrible measures and a new lockdown that would be, I would say, terrible for the country.
That's very interesting. And picking back on what Sir Peter was saying, do you think some, you know, cities have been surprised that they've been singled out? So you mentioned Marseille. How are people reacting there, or is it just they accept that actually infections are on the rise and this is the inevitable consequence of trying to deal with it?
I would say that that's really the main point. I studied extensively the way the first wave was managed by public by the government, and clearly one of the problems was centralization. So you had same measures all over the country, even where when the vast majority of the country was absolutely, there was absolutely no circulation of the virus, and this was criticized. So there was the attempt to say, okay, let's trust local governments, local authorities, and try to have something more adjusted, more adapted to local situation. But clearly, this hasn't worked, because there is little willingness from local authorities to announce hard measures. So you have a blame game between central government and local authorities. And this is clearly something that is a big problem. And I would say there is a vicious circle of distrust. And the key to that, and that was very interesting to hear Maya Soulsby on that, the key is information and is data. What is missing from the beginning in France is clear data and data sharing. Until now, in most of the cases I've investigated, local mayors have not access to the real data of the infections in their cities. And I would say that's key. If you really have clear, detailed data that is shared inside a circle of trust, including the local mayors, then there is a way to work together around one table and to decide the best measures. But if you don't have this data, if you don't have this trust, then it's very difficult, and that's what we are witnessing now.
That's really interesting. So Peter, maybe I can turn to you then. Do you agree with that? Do you think people trust local authorities more? And do you think, you know, bearing this question of data and exchange of information, do you think you're receiving enough support from the UK government in trying to address and of course respond to this crisis?
I think the similarities of the UK situation with that in France are really quite remarkable, because certainly at a local level, the great frustration that those of us who are mayors or in leadership positions, and indeed our public health officials, the great frustration has been the lack of reliable, consistent data and information about what's happening in our localities. And while I think I take Nicolas' concern that perhaps local authorities aren't prepared to intervene in an effective and consistent way on all occasions, and that's perhaps true of politicians worldwide, that perhaps want to blame others for the difficulties. But the fact is that we have wanted to take the right action, but not being trusted either to have the powers to do it or to have the data to know what's needed and where. And we've certainly, even now, been very much hampered by the fact that the government has not been effectively collating and passing through to us the data about where the virus is in the community and where it's being transmitted in the community. And as a result of that, a lot of the enthusiasm, a lot of the expertise that we've got at a local level has been unable to be used effectively. We do have at local authority level, public health officials who know about disease, they know about working with communities, and they know those communities. In the absence of knowing where the virus is in those communities, they've found it very difficult to use that that expertise and that local knowledge.
That's really interesting. Danielle, I mean, you were explaining earlier the situation in Victoria obviously has been very different to other parts of the country. Do you sense similarities as well? What support did you receive from the government? Did you feel you had, or did Melbourne feel like it had the data it needed to kind of measure its response?
So because the health systems are effectively controlled at a state level, Victoria has its own data. So we don't have that problem of kind of information sharing in the same way. The major role for the Commonwealth government in this is one, economic support, providing, you know, additional income support for households and businesses, and it has really stepped up to the table in order to do that. The other area where there's a lot of overlap is our Commonwealth government is effectively responsible for aged care and the regulation of aged care, and that has been a really big problem in the second wave in Victoria. The systems and processes were not good in aged care centres, and what we saw was the virus really run rampant through quite a large number of centres, and that's been where a lot of our deaths have been. So to the extent we've seen back and forth between levels of government, it's really been more around that particular issue rather than about control of data or information, because it very clearly sort of sits within the powers of the state governments.
And on the economic point, you know, what consequences are there really for a federal country when some parts of the economy are shut down?
That's a good question. I mean, Victoria is about a quarter of the national economy. So when Victoria sneezes, the nation catches a cold economically. So we've absolutely seen, you know, what was looking like a reasonable recovery has been set back substantially by the outbreak in Victoria. I think it also had an impact on confidence around the country, and we know that, you know, getting business and consumer confidence back is incredibly important for the recovery. I think every state sort of looked at Victoria and thought, goodness me, we don't want to go there. So it does have a sizable impact on the country as a whole, undeniably.
Nicolas, did you want to come in on that point?
Yeah, if I can come back to what Maya Salisbury said about local knowledge, I think it's absolutely key. Because it's not only getting on board local authorities, it's getting on board civil society. And this is particularly important because this disease is not hitting everyone on an equal level. It is a socially determined disease. So you really have to know your neighborhoods. You have to know your communities. You have to reach out to them. And for that, you need NGOs, you need civil society. That's absolutely key. We have had in France one successful example in a region called Mayenne, which is a small part of the country, that had his first wave in July and August. It was not hit by the first wave, no circulation of the virus. But it came in July, and it came with migrants. It came in African communities, in the poor neighborhood of the city, because this virus is really socially determined. And by bringing it inside the fight, bringing inside this circle of trust I talked about earlier, local NGOs, with a way to communicate directly in the poor neighborhoods, in a way to direct the testing capacity in the right place. They have been able, they are now with one of the lowest level of circulation of the virus. So I think that's a very interesting example. It can give hope. But it shows also that if we want to be successful against that virus, you have to get people on board. You have to get NGOs and local knowledge, local capacity to communicate and reach out to people. That's absolutely key.
That's great. And I actually wanted to come on this communication point, because obviously cities and countries as a whole responding to the crisis over the next few months will, you know, the way that they respond will have a huge bearing for society and, of course, the economy, as Danielle was saying. So, Peter, you know, the government here in the UK has just introduced a series of measures that will apply in England, and the other regions have responded with new restrictions as well. You know, to what degree do you think the government has learned from the early phase of the pandemic in terms of communication, and sort of what lessons should it bear in mind for the coming months if you're thinking about sort of society in particular?
I mean, sadly, I don't think they've learned as much as they should have done. I mean, I think it is still the case that at a local level, the NGOs that Nicola was talking about, you know, don't feel engaged. The local administration, the local councils don't feel engaged. I think a very significant extent, you know, they feel that, you know, their engagement is, down to reading what comes out in the government news release and trying to make some sense of it and interpret it at a local level. And I think that failure to recognise that different localities have different perspectives, have different needs, and to engage with those local communities and to communicate effectively with them and to listen to them has been, lacking throughout. And even now is only something that they've partially learned from. I just think they haven't felt that they could trust local communities and engage with them in a way that I think would have been so much more useful than the very centralist, the very top-down approach that's been adopted in the UK.
And I'd like to come in on this point with our other panellists as well, but briefly, I mean, how do you think that can improve in terms of your communication with, central government? Is it that you should just be speaking more regularly? Are there specific initiatives that could be set up to improve this?
I think, yes. I mean, obviously, I've been talking and listening, are a part of it. But I think there's also, certainly in the UK, a failure of central government to recognise that actually local people do know something about their localities and do have something useful to say and on behalf of the government to communicate with those those local people. I mean, certainly Leicester, I think people may know, is one of the most diverse cities. I think that's certainly anywhere in Europe, and possibly wider than that. And the diversity of its communities is something that only local people can possibly understand and know how to communicate with. And for the government to have single central messages is just wholly ineffective.
Great. And on that point, Danielle, communication is crucial. And of course, not only just for society, but also for business. And I know that at the end of August, Grattan wrote a piece urging caution, saying the trends are good, but the government should not succumb to pressure to lift restrictions too soon. What's your view on that as well? Are they listening? And how could communication be improved?
So I'd say yes, they are listening, in that the government has taken a pretty cautious approach to coming out of lockdowns. And this context is obviously very, very different to the UK and the French experience, in that, we are within reach of getting to what we call radical suppression or zero community cases. So we have a very different target, and it's possible for us to get there. On the point about communication, our state premier for Victoria has done a press conference every day we've been in lockdown. So I think he's done a press conference every single day for the past 80-something days without a break. And I think that has been really important in creating the sense that the government's got things under control. As I talked about before, the real breakthrough moment was setting out that timetable, really clear about what restrictions will be lifted and under what conditions. But just to also weigh in the point about the more sort of localised responses, I would entirely agree with Nicola and Sir Peter about the importance of tailoring responses in local communities. We saw exactly the same thing during our second wave, that it was areas with socioeconomic disadvantage and often really large immigrant communities where the virus was spreading rapidly. It turned out that a lot of those state government materials, advice, they weren't being translated into enough languages. And I think it took the government time to get across that. But once they started working with those NGOs or community groups, it was much more effective at getting the messages out there, and that's really helped, I think, in bringing our numbers down so dramatically.
I think that's really important, isn't it? Because it's not only getting your message clear in terms of, as you said, the timetable, but also the restrictions and what's required of citizens, but also making sure that they actually understand and, can, have adequate command of English or whatever. And I know that in London, particularly at the start of lockdown, you saw lots of communities come together and offering free translations and stuff like that. Nicolas, we saw President Macron give many, many nationwide addresses. How do you think the sort of French public has responded to his management of the crisis? And what do you think, what lessons can be learned for how or maybe how not to to communicate with the public?
I think that these very dramatic communications from speeches from the president, they clearly had a strong impact. So when it came to be very, very frank, to frighten everyone and to have a successful lockdown, it was really very successful. But it can't be the only tool that should be used by the government. And what we have seen, I have to say, through this question of the communication, is an institutional problem in France with two things. The first thing is the fact that we have a very strong President de la République, and we have a prime minister. And this double responsibility has been a burden for the management of the crisis, and especially for the communication, because you don't have one clear communication and you don't have inter-ministerial cooperation on the subjects and on the communication. And it is today, we can see it is a problem because you have the health minister communicating yesterday, but you have the education minister or the minister for higher education that clearly don't have the same agenda and don't send the same messages. So I would say that's the first problem. We really have to think again about how the state is communicating and how we can really build a united communication. And then there is a question of the social networks. Clearly, they are underused. Clearly, they are singled out as where the populist and the fake news are spreading information, but they are not used enough to spread good information, to listen, and to talk directly to the people. And during my interviews in the spring, when I studied the first wave and the response of the government, I interviewed a local mayor in a very small city, 2,000 people, and on the countryside. And the local mayor set up a Facebook group. And very, very rapidly, you have several thousand of people on this Facebook group sharing their questions. And you have all the branches of the local authorities. You had the police, you had the mayor, you had the health services sharing information because they had to answer to people. So the silos were very easily broken because you had this tool of communication. All the government agencies, local authorities had to share information with the people and among each other. And it was a great way for people to share their questions, also to share their fake information, telling, is this true or not? And you could see very clearly on the local level the effectiveness of communication through social networks. And clearly there is a lack of strategy at the national level on this stage. And in 2020, I think that's a big problem. That should be a priority.
That's really fascinating. So, Peter, have you had similar sort of platforms for communication, or is this something that you've been thinking about?
Yes, but I think it's a very interesting contrast with French governance systems, and obviously the UK is very very much centralised in its governance, and the role of local government and the expectations of local government from central government and indeed from localities is very different from that in France, and I guess also from that in Australia. We are probably one of the most highly centralised countries in the democratic world, and that I think has been a major handicap dealing with the challenges of the virus, because perception of government is that they know best, and that they are the ones best placed to decide not just the overall national strategy, but what should be happening at a local level. And I think that failure to engage both with the local administrations and with the NGOs at a local level has been a major handicap in the whole of the handling of the coronavirus. And it has meant that although local government has sought to engage with its communities, it has often felt itself excluded from any of the real decision-making and excluded from the information that it needs to communicate effectively. I think, you know, I said, reflecting on what Nicolas said about the French situation, it is something that I think has been quite a significant, has had quite a significant impact on something as challenging as the epidemic has been.
That's fascinating. I mean, Danielle, obviously, if you know, Australia has a federal system, it's slightly different. But, you know, what has been your sort of main takeaway on the communication side? And what, in your view, has worked particularly well in Melbourne?
I think the daily press conferences, which are both between our Premier and our Chief Health Officer, are amazingly widely watched. They've almost become sort of must-see television in Melbourne, and there's a whole school of thought around, you know, what the Premier's wearing today and what that means for the numbers. And, you know, they've actually been pretty effective. It was, when Nicola was talking about social media, I just went and had a look on Twitter, and the Chief Health Officer's got a very big profile on Twitter. He, you know, tweets the numbers and the information, but also, you know, it's quite sort of engaging in his presence, and he's actually seen as a bit of a heartthrob in Victoria. So, look, I think the messaging has actually worked fairly well, and I think it is that consistency of approach, willingness to put the numbers out there. So in terms of our knowledge of, you know, where the clusters are, how big the numbers are, you know, that's all on the public record. We have been a bit critical of the government in terms of withholding information that goes to the question of how effective they've been in their response. So information, for example, about how long contract tracing takes, you know, what's the average time to trace contracts, that sort of information hasn't been on the public record. But that's probably a small quibble in the context of some of those broader issues that others are talking about.
That's really fascinating. I guess the sort of last thing I really wanted to come to was, you know, with so much uncertainty in the balance, it's really hard to predict what will happen over the next few months. If you were to give the UK government, or any government for that matter, you know, advice, what would be your top tips? Maybe, Nicola, I can start with you.
I mean, again, coming back to what we said, top tips would be clear data, shared data, and predictability. And I guess that was the sense of the question of Peter about the threshold and the phasing. I think this has to be very clear, because it is bringing a sense of responsibility. If all the measures are clearly predictable depending on objective facts and data, then everyone has to be responsible. Everyone has to act on time. So that's what I would say, predictability and data sharing.
Great. Danielle, what would be your top tip?
So entirely agree on the data point. You know, what we've seen in Melbourne is just the importance of getting the things that governments can actually control right. So, you know, really widespread, widely available, free, rapid turnaround testing, good contract tracing, paid pandemic leave was a real breakthrough for us. So people could actually stay home when they felt sick rather than soldier on if they couldn't afford not to work. Really important to get the protections around aged care and healthcare strong. And as we said before, I think the other one is, you know, that locally based communication, particularly for communities where English is not their first language.
Right. And Sir Peter.
Yes, I think I would agree entirely with Nicola that, you know, the sharing of data and information is absolutely crucial to what the government should be doing. And I think it needs to be consistent about its messaging and the thresholds it's applying and its decision making. I think beyond all of that, I think that the central government needs to be realistic. Not to overpromise and not to raise expectations, but to be realistic. And I think sharing and being realistic are, I think, at the heart of addressing what is something that is obviously going to be a major challenge for many months to come.
Yes, definitely. And I think sharing also can be helped by sort of learning from individual experiences from cities and countries across the world. I think that's all we have time for this time. Thank you so much to my panel, Sir Peter, Danielle and Nicolas, for their time this morning. Well, evening for you, Danielle. And thank you to our listeners.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you've enjoyed this edition of IFG Live. Please do subscribe to hear more. And if you'd like to know about our upcoming events, please visit instituteforgovernment.org.uk/events.